Thank you. So, as you just said, this is a rather diverse audience, and while preparing my talk, I was hesitating between giving a review and telling you specialists, about what I'm working on right now. And so I tried to do both, and so I asked the patience of the specialists until the second half of the talk. So this slide, for instance, is definitely for the non-specialists. We're trying to study this partition function, this path integral in Euclidean time. And this is the action density for QCD with the gluons and the quarks. And we discretize space-time on a four-dimensional hypercubic grid. The fermion, the matter fields, fermions live on the sides, and the gauge fields live on the links joining neighboring sides. We discretize the action, so that the Dirac operator that sits here is replaced by a symmetric derivative involving the forward links and the backward links, or variants thereof. And the Young-Mitz action is discretized into the trace of product of four links going around an elementary square, which is called the plaquette. So this is our lattice action. And then we want to study, especially in this talk, the theory at finite temperature. And for that, as you will know, we compactify the imaginary time direction, which the compactification size gives us with the inverse temperature. OK, so I would classify the scope of lattice simulations into three categories. So let's first consider the one-body category, where lattice QCD simulations have done a wonderful job of studying with high precision the properties of a single hadron, a three-quark baryon, for instance. So as you know, the quarks are confined. So you can look at one bound state of such quarks with color singlet, and then you get you reach a precision nowadays of a few percent, sometimes a percent. And that's a big achievement of these simulations. Now, you can consider something harder, which is the two-body problem. So consider two of these color-neutral objects. Even though they're color-neutral, they still interact by the analog of van der Waals forces in electromagnetism. And this interaction, of course, is a nuclear interaction. So from QCD, you should be able to reconstruct the nuclear potential. And two big groups worldwide, led by Hatsuda and Savage, are working on this problem. And the goal is to reproduce, from first principles, the hardcore repulsion and the pion exchange attraction at large distances. And now you can go beyond the two-body problem and look at the many-body problem and try to study the property of matter made of these color singlets, so nuclear matter. And in particular, you can ask what is the behavior of nuclear matter as a function of temperature and density, or instead of density or pressure, you can consider the chemical potential associated to the quark charge. So this is this last many-body problem, which is the most difficult and which I'm trying to say something about today. So to get an idea of what to say, I looked up a good reference. And this is what Wikipedia says the phase diagram of QCD might be. So this is temperature, and this is chemical potential conjugate to the color charge. And you see that there's a beautiful non-trivial structure. Normally, we sit either here, where we have isolated hadrons, or there, where we have nuclear matter. Under extreme conditions, you can have another behavior for this quark matter realized in the universe. For instance, the early universe started very hot and with a zero net density of baryon. So it started here and then cooled down. So it crossed this crossover temperature where one goes from a more or less free quark gluon plasma to a confined phase where carosymmetry is broken. And this intermediate regime here is studied by relativistic heavy ion collisions, which try to explore this region of the phase diagram. And then that region is realized in the core of cold neutron stars, where the temperature is very low and the density is extremely high. And one doesn't really know what may happen there. Based on asymptotic freedom, the coupling becomes weak when the reference energy scale is large. So up there, you have asymptotically a free quark-gluon plasma. Up here, you have an attraction between quarks at the perturbative level, which gives you diquark condensation, and one expects Kolob superconductive phase there. Now, this can be even more complicated. In this intermediate regime here, many speculations have been proposed: crystal phase, quark-ionic phase, strangelet, etc. So there could be a very rich phase diagram here, even richer because the three in QCD, the charges of the up, down, and strange quarks are conserved separately, so we can introduce three different chemical potentials, and there's a very large four-dimensional parameter space in principle to explore. So let me simplify this parameter space a little bit. If you introduce two constraints, that of electric neutrality and that of stability and the weak interactions, then these two constraints reduce the three chemical potentials to one, this one. And this is basically the more or less agreed minimal phase diagram that one expects. And this is based on asymptotic freedom. And it's based also on this lattice determination that as you go here, you don't have a real transition, you just have a crossover. So this dotted line is a crossover. This solid red line is a first order transition, and it ends with a QCD critical point that one would love to find either both experimentally and by numerical simulations. And here you have this Kolob superconducting phase. Now, I would like to emphasize that this phase really does not need to be a separate phase. Why? Because the what happens there is that diquarks condense, but diquarks are not gauge invariant. They carry color indices. So you cannot actually formulate a gauge invariant order parameter for this phase, and therefore there's no order parameter that distinguishes this regime from that regime, and therefore there doesn't need to be a phase transition at all. So instead of this conventional fiction, like it's been called, the phase diagram of QCD might look something like that. one has to be prepared for moderate ambitions. And I think it's good to know from the beginning that this is a possible outcome of what we've said.
So in that diagram, that first order?
Yes. So this is also experimental input. Suppose you're at zero temperature, then your system remains empty until you have enough chemical potential to create a nuclear matter. Mm-hmm. And this happens here, and it's a first order transition, so nuclear matter sits there, and the attraction between nucleons is of order 15 MeV. So if you raise the temperature to something of order 15 MeV, this first order transition becomes weaker and weaker and ends with a critical point. And already establishing the location of this critical point experimentally is already a big challenge, as I learned.
Isn't it strongly believed that at sufficiently high density, U1 baryon number is spontaneously broken and it's a superfluid?
So what may happen here, if you just take QCD, is you take two nucleons and they have a weak attraction. So indeed, there could be a superfluid phase, not necessarily at very high densities, because the nucleons may not survive there. But
nuclear matter.
Yeah, in nuclear matter.
I don't care whether it's recognizable nuclei or not. It's just baryon number is a global symmetry, and it could be spontaneously broken.
Yeah, so there should be a superfluid here at extremely low temperature and presumably does not survive the introduction of additional interactions that we can imagine. So one would like to settle all these important issues by numerical simulations, and they're stuck to this vertical axis or very near it because of this infamous sign problem. So the situation, to make an analogy, is similar to studying water, and in these coordinates of temperature and pressure, suppose you're stuck on this vertical axis and you would have to guess for the critical point about all these beautiful phases of ice, etc. And for those who like Vonnegut, there's actually an analog of ice 9 in QCD, which is strange. So it could be interesting to discuss it on the computer. So what is the sign problem? As I said at the beginning, you have gluons and quarks. The quarks are fermions. You can't deal with fermions on the computer because they anti-commute. So what you do is you integrate them out. The action is bilinear. When you integrate out the fermions, you get a determinant. And this determinant has this property, this symmetry, which tells you that when mu is equal to zero, the determinant is real, or the same thing if mu is pure imaginary. But otherwise, there's no protection of the determinant which would keep it from being complex. So in general, except for these special cases, the determinant can be complex and presumably will be. And this complexity of the measure prevents the applicability of standard Monte Carlo. You can't consider this complex determinant as a sampling measure anymore. So you can't apply Monte Carlo. Maybe that tells us that it's a bad idea to integrate over the fermions. We'll see that later. So not only the determinant may be complex, but it must be complex to get the correct physics. So how do we see that? So suppose we introduce in our four-dimensional box with finite temperature, suppose we introduce a static charge, a static color charge, and its whirl line will be this closed vertical line, closed by boundary conditions, which we call the Poljakov loop. And the expectation of the trace of this loop gives us the free energy of this static color charge. And if the measure is the omega, then this is the expectation value. Now, for an anti-charge, the expectation value will be that of the conjugate loop, the loop going down downwards. And the free energy of an anti-charge will differ from that of a charge only by this sine fit here. So there will be a difference here only if the measure itself has an imaginary value. And so turning on a chemical potential is done for the purpose of distinguishing between charge and anti-charge. So we want precisely to have this difference of free energy, and that in turn forces us to have a complex measure. So the sign problem is there to get the correct physics. And it's a sign problem basically because the non-zero chemical potential breaks charge conjugation, which is itself related to complex conjugation. So what do we do? We're in a situation where we have an oscillatory integrand, and you would like to sample the integral. So let's take the simplest example with one degree of freedom and have a non-zero lambda here. So if lambda would be zero, then we would have a nice Gaussian here with a width of order one. And to sample this Gaussian, it would be sufficient to explore the regions of x around between plus one and minus one or so. Now, you see that once you have this oscillatory behavior, there are cancellations, of course. The result of the integral is exponential minus lambda squared over 4, so that even if you go up to x equals lambda and you truncate your integral there, you will still make an error of 100%. So now you have a second scale. It's not just the width of the envelope that matters. It's the value of lambda, the coefficient of the imaginary part in the action. And so what one says loosely that every X is important, but it really, it's essential to sample over a much broader range than one would in the absence of the sign plot. So let me walk you through what people do. This is the task. You want to sample or evaluate this partition function where F can be negative. Since you do Monte Carlo, you need to introduce an auxiliary partition function called ZG, which is the integral over a positive or non-negative measure. And then your generic expectation value W with respect to F, the one that you want to evaluate, can be rewritten by multiplying and divided by G here, and same thing is the denominator, and then normalizing numerator and denominator by ZG. Then you have here a ratio of two expectation values with respect to the auxiliary partition function. So this is called reweighting or pushing the sign into the observable, because what you measure now is the expectation value with respect to G of the original observable times this reweighting factor F over G. And the denominator, the average of the reweighting factor, is called the average sign. And notice that it's simply the ratio of the two partition functions, the one that you want divided by the one that you introduce for Monte Carlo purposes. So far, you're entirely free to choose G as you wish. It just has to be non-negative. But then there are better choices than others, and this you can understand because this denominator here will be there in every expectation value. So the error on the denominator will propagate into the error over any observable. So it's a good strategy to minimize the relative error on this denominator. And in order to do that, the solution is simply that G should be the absolute value of F. Okay? And then the ratio F over G is plus or minus 1. That's why it's called the sign. Now, now comes the problem that since this average sign is a ratio of two partition functions, you can write it as the exponential of the four volume times the free energy density. So you see that as you increase the volume or lower the temperature, this average sign will go to zero exponentially fast. On the other hand, each measurement of F over G, in this case, for instance, will give you plus 1 or minus 1. So the error on this average sign will be just the variance, which is 1, divided by the square root of the number of measurements. And so you have a quantity whose average is very small, and you need to maintain accuracy on this average, because otherwise it's going to, the inaccuracy is going to propagate into every observable you try to measure. So you want to maintain accuracy on this very small average value, and each measurement gives you plus 1 or minus 1. So you want to maintain this denominator to be as small, to compensate for the smallness of the expectation value, and that means the statistics have to grow exponentially fast in the four volume. Okay. So here is the exponential complexity of this sign problem. It tells you right away that you won't be able to study the thermodynamic limits or the low temperature limit. So this is true for any kind of sign problem. Let's see what happens for QCD specifically. So for QCD, if you have NF flavors, then your fermion determinant is raised to the power NF. and the partition function that you would like to sample just takes into account the real part of this determinant. So the imaginary part always cancels out because the partition function itself is real. So the optimal strategy would just be to take the absolute value of this real part of the determinant, and that would minimize the relative error on this average sign. That would be optimal, except you don't know how to recast this in a Gaussian integral that's easy to sample. So several people have suggested this over the years, but it's not practical suggestion, a much simpler and more efficient compromise is to sample instead the magnitude of this complex determinant raised to the power nf and forget about the phase. So this is called the phase-quenched approximation, for obvious reasons. And now you can recast this magnitude raised to the power nf into a product of two determinants, each raised to the power nf over 2, and these two determinants are a complex conjugate of each other. But now in this form, it's clear that what you do is introduce opposite chemical potentials to half of the quark species. So if you give them an isospin, you give chemical potential plus mu to the up quarks minus mu to the down quarks. So this is the ensemble that you now want to sample by Monte Carlo. It has no sign problem, and then you want to reweight it to the desired baryonic chemical potential ensemble. The problem is that if you introduce such a chemical potential, then this chemical potential is going to couple directly to mesons, which are UD bar, or vice versa. So these are mesons, so they're going to condense if the chemical potential is large enough. So the Monte Carlo ensemble that you sample will have a phase diagram which includes the phase transition. The blue one corresponding to condensation of pi plus mesons. On the other hand, the ensemble that you would like to study has a phase diagram which is presumably something like that, when at zero temperature nothing happens until you have enough chemical potential to create nuclear matter. So the two phase diagrams are very dramatically different, and it just tells us that the free energies of these two ensembles, the one that you sample and the one that you want to study, these two free energies are very different. So you're going to have a severe sign problem as soon as you cross this blue phase transition. Mm-hmm. This statement can be made more precise. This average sign is the ratio of these two partition functions, which you can study, especially in this regime, by analytic means. The ratio is ultraviolet finite because these two ensembles differ just by boundary conditions that you apply by changing the chemical potential in one of the species. So you can really apply all your analytical power of random matrix theory or chiral perturbation theory to make predictions about this average sign. This has been done very successfully. And of course, the main conclusion is this one, that it's outstandingly difficult to cross this blue line. What I've done is to use the hadron resonance gas at temperatures below this red line here, and make the following prediction: that if you say that in order to control your Monte Carlo, this average sign has to be at least 0.1. Then that puts a restriction on the number of baryons that you can study. And if you choose your temperature near here, then that tells you that you will not be able to study more than 10 baryons or so in your ensemble. So that's the best you can hope if you're willing to cope with this kind of sign problem. If you lower the temperature, then this number of 10 baryons is going to drop exponentially fast. And if you increase the volume, it turns out that this number barely changes. So with reweighting techniques, you should be prepared to accept that your results are going to be based on a statistical ensemble not exceeding around 10 baryons. It's going to be difficult to settle on questions like a phase transition if you only have 10 baryons in your system. So, this is the preferred the method I suggest to simulate this ensemble and reweight with the phase, and surprisingly, it hasn't been used very much. People prefer to, because it's simpler perhaps, to simulate at zero mu, and that's certainly worse because you also have fluctuations not just in the phase for the reweighting factor, but also in the magnitude. And then you run the danger of this so-called overlap problem, which which means that if the configurations that you sample are here in some multidimensional phase space, but the ones that you want to study are there, then if you only have finite statistics, you will never have any configurations representative of what you want to study. And it's the tail of your distribution that matters. So let me illustrate this overlap problem again by a problem example with one degree of freedom. Suppose you sample this Gaussian, but you would like to extract information about this shifted Gaussian. So this is the red Gaussian that you sampled by Monte Carlo, but you would like to evaluate, for instance, the average value of x in this shifted Gaussian, and the average value of x, of course, would be x naught if you shift it by x naught. Now, in this simple problem, I performed a little experiment. As a function of x naught, the shift in my Gaussian, I measure the reweighted average x. And of course, the correct answer is that x should be equal to x naught, the diagonal of this figure. And what you see instead is that if my shift in the Gaussian, in the green Gaussian, exceeds a certain value, which is related to the width of my original Gaussian, then I get the wrong answer. Not only I get the wrong answer, but I get an answer which is statistically inconsistent with the correct answer. Of course, it's my mistake. I underestimated my statistical errors. But this is a danger that one should keep in mind. That here the expectation value that I measure saturates. It just corresponds to the largest to the value of x, the deepest in the tail that I could sample towards this green Gaussian. And it has very little to do with the correct value that I should find. Associated to this is the fact that my reweighting factors are very non-Gaussian, and that's the reason why my error analysis is wrong here. And in fact, instead of being Gaussian, they're actually log normal, as Dave Kaplan and collaborators have pointed out. So the error analysis should be completely revised, taking this into account. So yeah, not only there's a sign problem, which tells you that you have a lot of statistical noise in your measurements, but you may even have, if you're unlucky or if you're too adventurous, if you try to reweight too far, you may even have the wrong answer and not even see it. So what's the history of using this reweighting strategy for QCD? But there was a long history of defeat, of obviously wrong answers. And then there was a breakthrough by Fodor and Katz, where they suggested, instead of keeping the temperature fixed and reweighting in mu in the chemical potential, let's choose for a temperature for a Monte Carlo ensemble this critical temperature or pseudo-critical temperature, so that our Monte Carlo ensemble has a mixture of configurations which are confined and deconfined. That's a good starting point to study a phase transition. And then we reweight this ensemble along this critical line, and we know here it's a crossover, and we're trying to detect the onset of a genuine transition here at the critical point, followed by first order transition. And the way they did this is by looking at the imaginary part of the Lignon zeros, which is something like the inverse of this peak of the specific heat. So here, this imaginary part of the Lignon zero is finite, extrapolated to the thermodynamic limit. So it's inverse. The peak of the specific heat is also finite. There's a crossover. But here, a zero value here tells you that the specific heat diverges and you have a true phase transition. So this point here corresponds to this particular point. And then converting into physical units, you get these values. But the question here is was there really a signal of a change in physics or a signal of a breakdown of the numerics? And this is the whole story, starting from mu equals zero that I obtained from Zoltan Fodor. And it's remarkable how little happens until all of a sudden something crashes. So 8 years on, it's still unclear whether really this is a critical point or just a numerical artifact. And there's a revival of this approach, especially for Wilson fermions, which maybe will settle these issues. One might hope to bypass this issue, at least at low temperature, by simulating an ensemble without any baryons and then putting the baryons a posteriori as sources and sinks. At zero temperature, one could do that. But as Lepage showed a long time ago, the sign problem occurs there too as a problem signal to noise. What happens is if this is your baryon correlator, with your three quarks here, then when you look at the variance of this correlator, you have to take this correlator times its conjugate, and then the quark propagators that enter in this product rearrange themselves into three pion correlators, so that this variance decays much more slowly than the square of the signal. And that's why you can get this signal-to-noise problem. But you can hope to maybe two or three variants here. So let's change strategy. Instead of trying to get the exact answer in small volumes, let's try to go to large volume with another method where we only get an approximate answer. And maybe the one big gain is that instead of not being so sure about the correctness of the results, maybe we'll have full confidence in that. So to get the approximate answer, we're going to look for a Taylor expansion in a small parameter. And this is the small parameter, mu over t. But we can do a Taylor expansion about mu equals zero, or something almost equivalent, do simulations at imaginary mu. Let me review what that means. So in the case of the Taylor expansion, you expand the pressure as a in a polynomial in mu over t. You really care about the difference in pressure generated by a change in the chemical potential away from zero. So you have this Taylor series, which is even, of course, and the Taylor coefficients can be measured in an ensemble at mu equals zero. So there's no difficulty simulating this ensemble. There's no sign problem at mu equals zero. You just have to measure some complicated expectation value, which is a polynomial of degree 2k for a coefficient c2k. And once you have these coefficients, then if you have a large number of them, then you can reconstruct with good accuracy the equation of state, look at the convergence radius of this series, get the critical point, look at the critical temperature, et cetera, et cetera. You have everything once you have the pressure. The practical difficulty is, of course, to get enough coefficients with enough accuracy. So the story starts easy enough. This is C2, this is C4, and already C6 has some wiggles and noises, etc. And after that, it becomes horrendous.
Anything known about the K behavior of CK?
Yeah, it's coming, yes. So these are the expectation values that you have to measure. For C6, this is the expression, et cetera. So it's a good problem for GPUs because you have many terms. You need to take the trace of each of these terms. And to take the trace, you estimate the trace by putting random noise vectors on the left and on the right. And so all these different factors can be estimated independently. And each of them needs a lot of computer time. So it's a good problem for a big cluster. The problem is the difficulty has to do with the complexity. How far can you push this strategy? So as I showed you, there's an increasing number of terms entering the C2K, and this number of terms blows up exponentially to start with. And then one knows that the answer is going to be finite, linear in the volume. On the other hand, each of the terms entering this polynomial can be as large as volume to the power 2K. So there are going to be tremendous cancellations, of course. There are plus and minus signs in there. So you want to go from this magnitude back to that magnitude, and that needs very good error control, and that's really where the sign problem resurfaces. Moreover, the various estimates that you obtain for this expectation value, which gives you C2k, are distributed in a more and more non-Gaussian way as k increases. And finally, you need larger volumes to control the finite size effects on C2k. So this is the current best. And that's a big achievement, of course, but one should not be over-optimistic. For instance, if you want to estimate the convergence radius of this series so that you can tell whether or not there's a critical point at some value of mu, then you need many more than four coefficients on toy models. It appears that you need more than 20, in fact, to get some reasonable estimate of the answer. So an alternative to a Taylor expansion strategy is to simulate that imaginary mu. Also there's no sign problem, as I say. And so once you have independent results for some observable at different values of mu I, then you can fit them by a polynomial, and then the coefficients of the polynomial are estimators of your derivative. So it's the same strategy, but implemented a slightly different way. And of course, again, the sign problem is there in another avatar, namely the coefficient that you would like to measure here is damped by k factorial, so it's very difficult to extract. Moreover, it turns out that the series on the side of imaginary mu is alternating. So this is an example where the pseudo-critical temperature is plotted as a function of mu square. So real mu, where you would like to have the answer is there, and imaginary mu, where you can do the simulations, is here. So you can see this is almost straight, but it's almost straight because higher order terms cancel each other. And estimating accurately these higher order terms is extremely difficult. So there's no free lunch as usual. Question?
Yeah. Yeah. About the CK, the CK is the experimental measure. They corrode. There are some capabilities that describe some fluctuations.
Not only they can be measured experimentally, but also theoretically, you know how they behave at very high temperature from a free gas. And at temperatures slightly below TC from a hadron resonance gas. So you have good limits on those four sides. So there's a renewed interest, at least from my point of view, in imaginary mu because of the phase structure of QCD as a function of imaginary mu. So let's give up temporarily on a real chemical potential. Maybe something interesting happens also at imaginary chemical potential, and it's an interesting problem per se. And indeed, there are these so-called Obertovice transitions. Let me not get into these details. But many of you are familiar with this Columbia plot, which at mu equals zero shows you the behavior of QCD as a function of temperature for different quark masses. So these are the up and down quark masses. This is a strange quark mass. This is the chiral limit. This is the quench limit when all masses are infinite. And in these two corners, you have first order transitions. So these green lines are second order lines separating the first order region from the crossover in the middle. And then here I plotted mu square. So imaginary mu, which is completely accessible to numerical simulations, sits below this mu equals zero plane. And at this particular value of mu over t, imaginary, this is called the Robertovice plane. And in this plane, you have a tricritical line here, another one there. And with these tricritical lines, you have associated scaling laws with known critical exponents. And it turns out that at least here, where the simulations are easy, in the case of heavy quarks, the scaling region around this tricritical line extends all the way to real mu. So this is shown here, again, mu over g, negative here. So this is the critical point that's here. And if you know the exponent, so you can do a one parameter fit of the amplitude and fit it through the imaginary mu data, and it describes also the real mu data perfectly. This is, of course, absolutely fantastic. One would dream that it happens also here, and probably not, but it's worth investigating. So that's one project underway.
Now, what's the difference from the previous slide where the imaginary can does not really extend? I mean, the previous one. Yeah, here you said that from the imaginary can potentially, it's hard to extrapolate.
Yes.
The ALU, but the next slide, there is a new hope. What is the future extension? Two situations.
So here, this is, of course, a cartoon, but these two surfaces here are constrained by these lines of tricritical points. And so if you can, numerically, there's no sign problem here, so you can pin down these lines. You know what the critical exponent is, so there's only one parameter, which is the amplitude, as if it did. Since you can also pin down this line here, you can exactly determine the amplitude and see, at least make a guess as to what happens for
the minimum. Okay, so the Greek tricritical line is the new input.
Right, exactly. So I described several approaches. Of course, one would like to check that they're consistent in a small volume, and this was done a while ago. If you see that there's good agreement between all these colors, which represent different methods, as long as mu over t, this vertical line is here, mu over t is equal to 1, where mu is the quark chemical potential. And more recent cross checks are underway or have been presented. So for small mu, everything works well. Now, let me show you recent progress. This is a beautiful artwork by Fodor and Katz and collaborators. What they determined was the pseudo-critical temperature. You know, at mu equals zero, it's a crossover. So you can determine how this Tc changes with mu. And what they did was just measure the curvature. So the first derivative, it's an even function of mu, so the curvature is all it takes at leading order. And you see several things in this figure. First of all, it's a crossover here, so you can adopt different definitions for what Tc is. And here are two different definitions, which differ by about 20-30 MeV. They show the same curvature. Very similar curvature, and this curvature is much smaller than the experimentally determined curvature of the Friesshardt curve, and that's bad news for experimentalists, because if there is a critical point, it must sit at somewhere here where these two pseudo-critical estimates meet, because once you have a critical temperature, it's unique, it does not depend on the particular definition. So if there is a critical point, these two curves should meet, and then that's the location of the critical point, and that's going to be rather far from the Friesshardt curve, which means the evolution of the hadronic fireball may wash out the signature of a critical point by the time the chemical composition of the fireball freezes. Another important feature is, as I said, these two curves don't seem to approach each other very much, which would be the requirement, a necessary condition for a critical point to exist. So from this picture, one would say if there is a critical point, it has to stay on the right of the edge of this figure, which means, again, mu over t, the quark chemical potential divided by t, has to be at least 1. So this obtaining this figure requires, I believe, measuring five successive derivatives of the pressure in the continuum limit. Another illustration of the state of the art is to measure the curvature of this critical surface that I showed before, a few transparencies ago. And this requires 8 derivatives of the pressure, but this was done only on a very coarse lattice. And the result qualitatively is similar in the sense that what is found is that the curvature and even the subleading term along this vertical line tend to shrink the region of first order transition, which makes it impossible for a critical point to be found up on this vertical line. So again, in the region where this Taylor expansion can be trusted, which is mu over t less than 1, it's very unlikely that there would be a critical point to be found. Of course, there's a Rigg energy scan, which is going to give us, hopefully, the true answer. So let me spend the remaining 15 on what I'm working on now. I have a plan to tame the sine problem. And basically, the starting point is, as I showed you at the beginning, as soon as you integrate out the fermions, you have this determinant. The determinant is complex. Nothing you can do about it. So let's not integrate out the fermions. Let's avoid this determinant by reversing the order of integration. Integrate out the gauge links first, and then the fermion. Is that going to be better? That's not clear, but it's going to be different. And maybe you can be lucky. There's no such thing as a conservation law for the sine problem. Suppose you manipulate in your Monte Carlo eigenstates of your transfer matrix, then of course the matrix elements of your transfer matrix are all going to be zero or positive, and you will not have any sine problem. So the closer, I think the intuition is, the closer you can get to manipulating by Monte Carlo physical degrees of freedom, the better off you are. So what I want is, instead of manipulating gauge fields, local gauge fields, I want to manipulate whirl lines of hadrons. And that's clearly, in my scale, that's closer to physical degrees of freedom. So how do I do that? Again, this is my Euclidean path integral. This Young-Mills action is discretized into the trace of this plaquette going around a little square. So this term here, it couples four links. It's a four-link interaction. Let me just turn that off for now. So I'm going to take the strong coupling limit, take G0 to infinity, and then this plaquette term disappears. And now the gauge links just enter in these covariant derivatives here. And the measure on the gauge links factorizes. I just have a product of one link integrals, each being of this form here. So this one link integral I know how to do analytically. Once I perform the integral, I only have color singlets. I've done the color integration. So I only have color singlets. I can further integrate over the Grassmann fields. And what I will be left with would be whirl lines of hadrons, baryons, and mesons. This is reasonably easy for staggered quarks. It hasn't been pursued yet for other formulations of the Dirac oscillator. So you can then do Monte Carlo with these whirl lines. And what you see is that the baryons make self-avoiding loops. So the physical picture in this strong coupling limit that you can extract is that you have hardcore baryons because they're self-avoiding. They're point-like. And they're immersed in a pion bath. And that's the whole system. There's no such thing as pion exchange, no visible interaction. Everything is color neutral. So here is an example of a configuration. The baryons are red-oriented loops. And the blue things, the blue symbols are mesons. So I have carboxyl, little dots, and lines which correspond to meson hopping, and I have a constraint coming from the Grassmann integration that I have three blue symbols or a baryon at every side. So this is a valid configuration. And now if I increase the baryon density, eventually I will reach this configuration. You know that baryons form self-avoiding loops, so there's nothing I can add to this configuration. It's completely full. In particular, I cannot add any tau of psi, little dots or monomers, and that tells me that the average value of tau of psi in this configuration is zero. So immediately here, I obtain that chirosymmetry is restored in this dense nuclear matter, just like that. Moreover, well, I'm lucky, and the sign problem really is mild at all densities. So since this quantifies my statement, as a function of the chemical potential, this is the I'm putting here the free energy density that characterizes the severity of the sign problem. You see that my ansatz here is perfectly verified for different volumes. They fall on top of each other once I divide this log by V. And so the sign problem is very mild here at small mu, very mild here at large mu, and peaks around the region of phase transition.
So how do you move away from the strong problem?
Since this work, I'm going to spend 5 minutes showing you how it works. So, first of all, this works much amazingly better than the usual determinant approach. In the determinant approach, I showed you how to estimate the severity of the sign problem by comparing the free energy of these two and two partition functions. And I would have a delta F of order 1. Actually, I tried several years ago to do this by brute force in the determinant approach at strong coupling, and I couldn't get anywhere. So here, delta F is of order 10 to the minus 4. So I've gained 4 orders of magnitude in the severity in the exponent. So this is really much, much better. Moreover, if I identify the origin of the remaining sign problem here, what causes the negative sign configurations are baryons. So there are mesons, and the mesons are bosons. They don't give any sign problem. The sign problem comes from the fermions here. And specifically, when a baryon whirl line has a special hop, then depending on the geometry, it can give a negative sign contribution. So if you don't have any baryons, like in this region here, then there's no sign problem ever. And in particular, this system has no silver blaze problem. You can be at zero temperature, and the sign problem will be absent all the way until the phase transition. That's a big big indication of success. And similarly, if you have a high chemical potential, that means high density, and then, as I showed you, all the baryons are pushed against each other. They have no space to hop spatially, and again, there's no sign problem. That's the reason why there's a peak here in the middle.
This transition is solidification, going to a crystal here.
Yes. So of course, this is not QCD. It's a strong coupling limit of QCD. I'm nowhere near a continuum limit. I'm on a crystal, and I have a crystal with a saturation density at high chemical potential. Nevertheless, I can play interesting game, entertaining games. I can measure the masses of different isotopes. So here I measure the rest energy of a single nucleon, of two nucleons next to each other, three nucleons in two different geometries, and then I plot all this. This is the mass per nucleon, and this is my data. You see that here for A equals 4, I have one geometry which has a much smaller mass, and it's this one. The others have increased energy because they're further from being spherical, etc. And I can fit, or actually I don't fit, this blue line here is a truncated empirical Bethe-Weizsäcker formula where I have just two terms, one which is a bulk term for the mass of this nucleus, a bulk term, and another one is a surface term, going like A to the 2/3. And there are two parameters entering in this formula, the critical value of mu and the surface tension, which I can measure separately by different simulations. And once I put these two values in here, I get the blue curve, which describes my data quite well. Of course, normally this formula continues with isospin and electromagnetic corrections, but both are absent here in this story model. So, no, this one. I showed you cartoons of configuration, but I do with a 3 plus 1 dimension theory. Moreover, I can.
Wait a second. So, coefficients are not getting very better, right? The effect is much, much larger than the nucleus.
Right, yes.
Just similar shape, but not the same coefficients.
So, quantitatively, this has very little to do with QCM. So, for instance, the binding energy.
You don't expect it.
No, the binding energy of my deuteron is something like 100 MeV. And my surface tension is also order 100 or 200 MeV per square. But there are. So, I'm emphasizing the positive. So one thing you can do, it's a toy model, obviously, but you can extract some insight from this toy model. And one insight is, what is a baryon and how do baryons interact? So for me, this was very, I had not realized this before. So as I said, these baryons are point-like, and they're self-avoiding loops. So what you see, this point-like feature is just the hardcore of the baryon. But I showed you that there was a constraint, that these baryons were immersed in a pion bath. And so if you add a baryon, a static baryon in your pion bath, it's going to push the pions that were there before, and it's going to distort the surrounding pion bath. And because of this distortion, the pion bath is going to require additional energy. So the introduction of this hard core generates a distortion which carries energy and has a profile, an energy profile, and that's what I would call a pion cloud. And the size of this pion cloud is macroscopic. It's the inverse of a meson mass. So naturally, you see in this Tonkov dynamic, you see the emergence of this structure for the baryon with a point-like hard core and Yukawa or an exponentially decreasing pion cloud around it. Now, if you have this picture in mind and you put two baryons with their clouds next to each other, then this is a sketch of each of these baryons with the core and the cloud. And now the core is preventing the cloud from sitting here. The blue core is preventing the red cloud from sitting here, and vice versa. The red core is preventing the blue pion cloud from being present there. So there's an interaction between these two nucleons coming from the cores disturbing the pion cloud. And just without any simulations, just from a linear response, you conclude that the nuclear potential is going to be related to, by factor minus 2, to the energy of this pion cloud, which you already know, by Kubo formula, is governed by this Yukawa form. So even though in this model there's no Yukawa exchange, there's no pion scattering off the baryon, there's no such thing. Nevertheless, you are forced to have a hardcore potential plus a Yukawa interaction large distance. So this insight to me is maybe the most beautiful outcome of this project. You can also determine the phase diagram with good accuracy in the chiral limit. No problem taking the mass to zero here. So in the chiral limit, you have a symmetry which is either broken, the chiral symmetry broken here, restored there. You have a phase transition, and you have a phase transition which is second order here, first order there, so you have a tricritical point. These different colors correspond to lattices with different number of slices. Of course, you're at some coupling, you can't really take the continuum limit, except you can try to do that in just one direction in Euclidean time, and then you get this red line. Okay, so the problem is entirely solved, completely solved. Now, somebody was there. How to go beyond beta equals zero? So the first step is to measure gauge observables at beta equals zero. That's non-trivial because the water gauge links have already been integrated out. So we've been working on this with Ove Philipsen also, of course. And this is, for instance, the Polyakov loop as a function of temperature at mu equals zero in the chiral limit. So there's a phase transition here, and the Polyakov loop has a non-zero value, and it has maybe a singular behavior corresponding to the second order phase transition. Now, the next step beyond that is to include the plaquette in the action, and at order beta, this is what we're working on all together, and that's hard. But now maybe here's a suggestion to go beyond order beta. As I explained, the problem with this plaquette term is that it couples four links around an elementary square together. So now I would like to decouple these four links from each other so that one can perform the one-link integral. And maybe that can be done by introducing auxiliary fields. So let me remind you what the Herbert-Stratanovich transformation is. You express this Gaussian integral, and you say, well, this is independent of the shift in the origin, the shift phi 0. So I can expand this square here and cancel some other term in my original action by choosing an appropriate expression for phi 0. Here is a particularly useful variant where this exponential of alpha times AB being two general operators, can be recast by introducing an auxiliary field phi. Now, let's look at this expression here. Or rather, take for A the product of these two links, U1, U2. Take for B the product of the other two links. And take for phi an auxiliary field associated with a diagonal. And if you plug that in, you will decouple your plaquette into two triangular terms. So you introduce this diagonal term, and you trade your original plaquette term for two triangle terms. What I would like to do is one more step and have only one link entering in the action, and maybe your suggestions are most welcome how to do that in a simple way. Okay, so I'm at the end. This is lifted from my old talk in Beijing, so this is the relevant statement here. And what I believe in is this plan that I outlined for you. And maybe something to follow is complex underline. I have a backup slide for people who want to know about complex underline. The better thing to do is to go to Seattle in 2 months' time, where there will be a program including a complexified path integrals. And I hear that one of the registered students is named Edwin. That should be interesting. And I did not cover these other methods. This one, I think, is not so different from the rest. And there are experts among the organizers to tell us about the density and state methods. Thank you very much.
Can you show us your one slide?
Yeah. Show it or talk about it? Okay, so stochastic quantization is the idea of Parisian rule that if you have an action S, that you can replace your Monte Carlo average by a time average. You introduce a pseudo fictitious time and a dynamics, which are Langevin dynamics, where your degree of freedom phi evolves with a gradient term and a noise term under this fictitious time tau, and you can prove that the solution of your Hockey-Planck equation gives you the correct expectation value with respect to your original action. This is all fine if S is real. Now, if you have a complex action, then this force here is complex, of course, and that will drive your original variable phi to be complex. So you have to complexify your field phi, and then you simulate the same evolution as before. And if you're lucky, or very lucky, then you get the correct long time average.
What does lucky mean?
So there are three outcomes. If you follow this recipe blindly, there are three possible outcomes. You converge to the correct answer. You diverge away to infinity, or you converge beautifully to the wrong answer. And distinguishing between correct and wrong answer is tricky.
And all three options have been observed.
And the wrong answer is the right answer for something, or it's just
that hasn't been understood yet.
Point is that for real action, there is proof that
right. You can still write down a Fokker Planck equation, but you don't know hardly anything about the solution. But I want to. Yeah, so what has the progress since 30 years ago is that you don't diverge anymore. The divergences seem to be caused by the too large step size, and so if you use an adaptive step size, this goes down.
It always converges to something. When you don't converge to the right thing, you don't have any meaning.
Right. So. But it's still very intriguing. One of the most recent papers of Herr Arts was to look at an XY model, where, of course, you know the correct answer. And he showed that you could actually get the wrong answer even in the absence of a sine problem. So you don't need a sine problem.
But it's a theorem. That's because of numerical points.
No, because of the landscape. So let me illustrate what happens in the case of a Gaussian. So let's take again this single degree of freedom problem. So as a function of x, the integrand looks like this, oscillatory. But now if you complexify, you see that this complex action has a saddle point, which is here. And in the complexified plane, your distribution would actually be a very nice and smooth Gaussian. So the presence and the relevance of classical saddle points is extremely important to the convergence of this complex model. And if you don't, or if you have too many of them, or if they're hard to explore numerically, then you get the wrong answer, even though there's no sign of that.
We know there's examples of systems which have complex actions or non-Hermitian Hamiltonians, and this business of PT symmetry is still same as well, right? Is there any connection between the recent work?
There is, yes.
That's
right. There is.
So, you said that Ed Whitney is going to this workshop. So he is going on storing these, or he discusses the story of complexifying the integral instead of complexifying in the differential equation.
I would love to go to the center of that company.
So there is a connection to PT symmetry and when you can do complex line?
That's what both parties say.
Any more questions?
Any more answers?
Okay, let's have it.